The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen, and we thank them for their continuous support. And we're reading from the June, can you believe it? The June 2022 edition of Smithsonian. First story, Flesh, Blood, and Bronze, a sculptor's Herculean effort to create the epic national monument to World War I, by Jeff McGregor. Light is everything, says the sculptor, and all at once it is. You see light as if for the first time, not as some condition of simple illumination, but as the maker of solids, the hand, the hammer, and the chisel, the creator. You see it sifting down from the ceiling and sneaking through glass doors, cascading from two big windows up front, the long room filled with it in every angle and on every surface, the whole place swelling with daylight pouring through the glass bricks out back. Iron light, straw light, light bright as brass, sun yellow, light corkscrewing from the skylights to settle across every unfinished face and figure, light gathering in the folds of the uniforms, washing the boot tops and the rifle barrels, radiant, hard as marble, soft as lamb's wool, painting the floors, drifting into the corners like snow, sleeping in the shadows, light on every body, indifferent light, animating light, sanctifying light. The sculptor is Sabin Howard. While his tools and materials suggest Howard works in clay and bronze, his true medium is light. And this sculpture, A Soldier's Journey, years in the making, will serve as the centerpiece of the National World War I Memorial in Washington, D.C. When complete, Howard's immense frieze will tell the story of an American reluctantly answering the call to war, a deeply personal and individual story, and the grand symbolic story of the nation, all at once. Across five scenes and 38 larger-than-life-size human figures, it will be nearly 60 feet long and 10 feet high, and it may become the greatest memorial bronze of the modern age. Sabin Howard is avid. Born and raised in Manhattan, in his youth, he and his parents, both educators, routinely visited Italy, where his mother was born. He spent summers there with his grandparents, back and forth, back and forth. Florence, Turin, Milan, walking museum after museum after museum, those long, cool marble hallways echoing. He spent almost as much time there as he did in the States, almost as much time in the 15th century as in the 20th. Very early in his teens, immersed in the art of the Renaissance, he knew what he was called to and what he was born for and where his gifts were meant to take him. Those talents, honed for years as both student and teacher at places like the New York Academy of Art and the University of the Arts in Philadelphia, and in his Bronx studio, and across tens of thousands of hours of drawing and sculpting and succeeding and failing, having led him here, a converted printing plant in Inglewood, New Jersey, and perhaps the most ambitious artistic commission of the 21st century. The high forehead hallowed by the pre-Raphaelite curls, the face at rest is smooth, useful, not cherubic, but affable, approachable, an effect achieved in part by wire-rimmed glasses. When he tells you something, those magnified eyes search your face to be sure you understand before telling you the next thing. He is funny and serious and modest and vain and naive and wised up. Sabin Howard is a concert of opposites and holds in perfect tension every imaginable trait of personality. He is placid and passionate, quiet and voluble, self-taught and well-schooled, patient and impatient, steady and mercurial, a woolly savant in thrall to the muses, and a guy with a lunchbox punching a clock. The energy produced by these tensions radiates off him in waves. Strong hands, as you would expect. He'll push 1,000 tons of clay 1,000,000 miles with just his thumbs before he's through with these panels. Barrel-chested and dressed for work in body-cut exercise shirts and board shorts. Howard is 58, but looks 15 years younger and 15 years fitter. Sabin Howard is ripped. He began to make his reputation 25 years ago in the art galleries of downtown Manhattan. His classic studies of the body in a time of postmodern patache and cerebral deconstructions of ornament and sentimentality were a sensation and a small revolution. As the New York Times wrote 20 years ago of a gallery show featuring his classical style, anatomically exact nudes, Sabin Howard, a sculptor of immense talent, has created some of the last decade's most substantive, realistic sculpture. When viewing his works, visitors may be reminded of the time when sculptors like Donatello and Rodin walked the earth. He sold his sculptures to museums and private collectors all over the world, sometimes making copies of the originals, and he taught art school courses, lectured online, gave private lessons. He wrote a book with his wife, the novelist Tracy L. Slatin, called The Art of Life, a sort of statement of purpose, thick with luscious photos of Sabin's work. The spirit of art is the reflection and also the springboard of the spirit of humanity, they wrote. It shows us ourselves. In figurative art, it literally shows us ourselves in our every dimension. It is revolutionary. It reveals not just who we are, but who we have been and who we can be in body, mind, spirit, and psyche. In this way, a great piece of art conjures magic. In 2015, the World War I Centennial Commission announced a design competition for a national memorial to the war. There was a feeling, a fear, that the legacy of the war was being lost, forgotten. The last combat veteran had died 4 years before at 110 years old. And though there was already a local monument on the National Mall dedicated in 1931 to the District of Columbia residents who fought and died in the war, the Great War was still alone among America's major modern conflicts, unrepresented by a comprehensive national memorial in the Capitol. The new site eventually chosen was Pershing Park, just off the mall and down the street from the White House, in front of the Willard Hotel. A statue of John J. Pershing, who'd led American forces during the war, had long stood watch here, but the rest of the space was exhausted. An important element of the international competition to design the memorial included redesigning the park itself. In 2016, the architect Joe Weishaar won the competition. Selected from more than 300 entries, Weishaar is from Arkansas and was then 25. So young, he looked like your neighbor's son home from college. I was working full-time for a firm in Chicago, he says. The memorial was sort of a weekend hobby for me. When everybody found out that I had won, my bosses weren't super happy. They felt like I was moonlighting on the side. But the commission appreciated that Weishaar's design was sophisticated in serving competing purposes. It had to include an appropriately solemn war memorial, and it also had to be an inviting, well-functioning, living, breathing city park. You want a memorial that is respectful, and you want a park that people can enjoy, says Edwin Fountain, General Counsel for the American Battle Monuments Commission, who spearheaded the event to erect the memorial. Joe's design works with the existing footprint of the park, the existing fabric of the park, the existing orientation of the park to its surroundings, and that in itself was a value. Howard, in a separate submission, had originally paired himself with a different architect, but the committee liked Howard's work. When Weishaar reached out to him about collaborating, he quickly signed on. You'd be forgiven for thinking that what this ensued was a battle between the artists and the Memorial Commission, the artist and the bureaucracy, the artist and the money. The cost of the park update and memorial is $44 million, largely raised from private donations. And you wouldn't be entirely wrong, but after a contentious beginning, during which every interested party expressed themselves clearly and emphatically, and sometimes heatedly, everyone now mostly gets along, that everything has been a negotiation, and everything has been a discussion, does not mean that everything has been a compromise. Far from it. For Howard, the process began with 12,000 photographs of models in action, then dozens of preliminary sketches. Sometimes the models couldn't find the pose, couldn't understand what Howard was after. "What is the pose depicting?" they'd ask him. "I began to realize this is a very movement-driven process," Howard says. So he told the models to perform the action, to crouch, to lunge, to charge, to fall, and he shot the whole sequence on his iPhone in burst mode, which takes multiple photographs in rapid succession. From the burst, we would extract the one pose of the 12 shots that explain the action. When you have a change occurring as you freeze a figure in time, eventually the models traveled with Howard to Britain to a studio with a custom-built photogeometry rig. 160 cameras in a 360-degree spherical arc around an elevated platform. The models in authentic period attire posed and recomposed and shot from every conceivable angle and captured in high definition until, at last, Howard had 30 final drawings and a 3D digital rendering of the tableau he sought. 40 hours a week for 2 years. From the renderings, a Marquette, a small-size model, 5 feet long, was made. Then a full-size, steel-framed foam armature, milled in England and shipped over in huge sections. It's upon this foam surface that Howard applies the clay that brings it all to life. His life-size bronzes, Hermes and Apollo and Aphrodite, all beautiful muscle and dynamic grace, are tucked into the corners of the studio. So the vibe is a sort of Greco-Roman cult of the body by way of Florence and Paris and Peloton. Someone is always doing a push-up or a sit-up or a pull-up or spinning the stationary bike over by the heat lamp and the big warming trays of plastiline clay. The whole gang of models and assistant sculptors bike or run or swim or lift weights, so there's exercise equipment and high-tech carbon fiber bicycle gear in every corner. Rodin and Donatello may have walked the earth, but more often than not, Howard bikes to work, fast and hard, all muscle and lungs, and dynamite tension on a bike as fine and sharp as a blade, clearing his head for the day's work. If Sabin Howard is avid, his wife Tracy is ardent. Smart and dark-haired, she is the heart on her sleeve, showrunner here, the project manager and lead accountant and den mother, the writer, producer, and thumbprint by thumbprint documentarian. The number crunching wrangler of dogs, politicians, commission members, children, fans, journalists, and seekers of the neoclassical and neorealist absolute. It is worth remembering that the Renaissance gave us not only Michelangelo, but also the Medicis and the Machiavelli, too. So she has had her hands full. She put her own career as a popular novelist on hold to do this. For the duration of the project, she makes sure the only thing on Sabin Howard's plate is sculpture and lean, high-protein meals. The way it's set up is Sabin sculpts and leads the sculptors, and I do everything else. Her office is in the front window of the studio. Behind her, running nearly the length of the 5,000-square-foot space, is the clay rendering of what will become the huge bronze. It is at once a frieze and a bas-relief, and a series of nearly freestanding figures. From left to right, it tells the story of an everyman gone to war. In the first scene, every man answers his call to duty. He kneels, penitent, while his wife rests her hand just above his heart, and his daughter presents him his helmet. It is a family intact, in a state of holy repose. In the second scene, the husband turns away from his family and begins his march to war. He locks arms with his fellow soldiers, joins them in step, and is pulled away from his wife. Her grip, even strengthened by worry, can no longer hold him. In the next scene, now armed with a rifle, he beckons those behind him forward, a call to arms, while his comrades raise their weapons and hasten their steps, and in the foreground, another crouches to pick up his gun and rise to join them. All of it gaining momentum now, urgency, all of it leaning into that awful history headlong, the terrible power and purpose and planetary pull of war, each man poised on the edge of his own mortality. And then the explosive rush up and out of a trench, soldiers charging forward, leaping, all muscle and grimace and courage and war cry as around them men fight and begin to fall. Now the sorrow. At the center of the memorial is a battlefield pieta. The wounded and the ruined and the lost are gathered there in the arms of the nurses and their fellow soldiers. The pace of the sculpture slows and becomes more ruminative, but no less dynamic, no less visceral. One soldier stands straight, undone, an awful stillness staring helplessly out, directly at the viewer, to some unfocused middle distance. To be witness to horror is not only one price we ask our warriors to pay. This figure, expressionless, indicts us all. Now the nurses lift the wounded and help them back to the ranks, easing them into the march home, where they shoulder their rifles and the flag. They raise their chins in pride or defiance or resignation and despair and walk back into a world that cannot understand them and which they no longer recognize. In the final panel, every man comes home. He is, of course, remade. He is a hero, reluctant, called and tested and strengthened, bearing to his people a message of order, rebirth, and hope out of chaos and violence and death, in the manner of the mythos preceding us all, going back to the beginning of history. Joseph Campbell called it the monomyth, also known as the hero's journey, a resemblance Tracy first pointed out to Sabin while he was already composing the tableau, and which gave the work its title and its clear narrative core. Sabin stumbled on it because it's so archetypical as to who we are as human beings, Tracy says. At last the father is reunited with the daughter, his hands back his helmet, into which she peers, divining the future in its shallow upturned pan. What does she see there? As any work of memorial art must, it tells its own story without writerly embellishment. I'm hoping to make something that lets a kid, when he's walking along the wall, experience it like it's a movie in bronze, Sabin says. The scenes are changing, and the kid goes home, and he's like, oh my God, I got to see what World War I was all about. And he gets the idea that we're on a journey, each and every one of us. Mornings in the studio are simple, everyone in and working by 8:30. No excuses. No wool gathering, no waiting for a bolt of inspiration to strike from the heavens. There's a deadline for every panel, and a deadline for the whole project. And art or not, the work is the work. The deadlines are on a spreadsheet in Tracy's office. She gives the sculptor 700 hours per figure. I start hassling them at 500 hours, she says. The planning and the design and the drawings and the photographs are long finished. This is a manufacturing process now. There are three sculptors working at once, often in three different parts of the big room. Sabin, Charlie Mostow, mid-room right now. At work on a leg is the first assistant. The second assistant sculptor position has been, well, dynamic and a source of some upset. Today, though, all is peace and perseverance over there by the main frieze. Sabin is in a corner up front by the office, hard at work. The project is being documented minute by minute on YouTube and Instagram. Capturing the soul in sculpture is about capturing the movement that is pushing out from the body, Howard tells the camera. Mark Puchinski, right now, modeling that leg for Charlie, is reading The Amazing Adventure of Cavalier and Clay. In order to hold the pose, Mark is propped on a padded stand built for the purpose. This is true for all the models and most of the poses, some of which are tortuous and might need to be held off and on for hours. Lunging, running, screaming, jumping, every act must be seen in every light and from every angle. A two-dimensional drawing or a photograph won't do. Every fold in every garment requires a live model. When Mark strikes the correct angle of ankle, calf, and thigh, the uniform covering his leg is artfully draped and held fast with clothespins for the length of time required to reproduce it in clay. What's really being sculpted is the muscle beneath the drapery, the effort, the vigor, the flesh. That, Howard says, is what creates tension and ultimately emotional drama. So the motion creates emotion. This leg, every leg, any leg, might take weeks of incremental attention from each sculptor. While not improvisational, the process here is adaptive, one of adjustment and counter-adjustment. Every inch of that giant sculpture will be made and remade. Although the foam core armatures bearing the real-time facial expressions of the models from the photogrammetry shoot came from England with a thin layer of sculpting clay already applied, it's the final layer applied here, by hand, one small bead at a time. That last millimeter of plastiline that breathes vitality into the piece. It's where the details are, where life is. The studio is filled with tools for moving and removing clay, spatulas as delicate as medical instruments, razor blades and calipers and scrapers and smoothers, wire loops and wire ribbons, rakes and tongs and fettling knives. But mostly it's thumb work, a small gesture, a delicate pressure, one smooth inch at a time. Thus does the leg from an early photograph become the leg in a drawing, become the leg in foam on the armature, become the leg in clay, until becoming at last the leg on the bronze, the leg they'll see in Pershing Park 100 years from now, unique in the world, full of life and purpose. While the sculptor's work, it is as quiet as a library, quieter. Madeline does her homework at the big table in back. She's Sabin and Tracy's daughter. She's 17 now. When she modeled for the girl in the sculpture's first and last panel, she was 11. During the early phases of the pandemic, everyone here, including Maddie and the dogs and every model and sculptor, was part of a quarantine pod. So the spirit here is not only that of a Renaissance-era Florentine workshop of master and apprentice, but of extended family. It's quiet, but not sleepy. There's plenty of coffee and every kind of tea. Lots of music, sure, but it's all earbuds and earphones. So what you hear might be the thin whisper of a melody, as if from the bottom of a well. It is rare to hear a phone ring. People mostly walk outside to talk on the phone. The Great War changed everything. It rewrote global treaties. It redrew the Middle East. It hastened a revolution in Russia. It moved the United States, reluctant and isolationist, to the center of the world stage. It solved the problems of the 19th century by creating the problems of the 20th. As the last act of the Industrial Revolution, it industrialized killing. It was an inglorious, mechanized war wrapped in the Victorian language of valor. The dissonance helped break art into a million pieces. Poetry, music, painting, movies, novels, none of it was ever the same. Jazz, Joyce, Yeats, Stein, Proust, Millais. In all my dreams, before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. The English poet Wilfred Owen wrote of the poor comrade in arms who was too slow to pull on his gas mask. Well, I hate to leave you hanging. That's not the whole reading, but we got most of it in. And I can't wait to see that World War I outdoor museum. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their continued support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.